This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is off today. In a moment, we're going to look at the week's news here in New England, but first, the news from Washington. Secretary of State John Kerry gave another impassioned speech about the Syrian problem today. He said the Syrian regime was responsible for a reported chemical weapons attack on August 21st that killed more than 1,400 people, including more than 400 children. Later on, the president of the United States, President Barack Obama, spoke. That was just minutes ago. We've got tape from him here. He said the military action by the United States against Syria, if any, would be limited.
This kind of attack is a challenge to the world. We cannot accept a world where women and children and innocent civilians are gassed on a terrible scale. This kind of attack threatens our national security interests by violating well-established international norms against the use of chemical weapons, by further threatening friends and allies of ours in the region, like Israel and Turkey and Jordan, and it increases the risk that chemical weapons will be used in the future and fall into the hands of terrorists who might use them against us. I have said before, and I meant what I said, that the world has an obligation to make sure that we maintain the norm against the use of chemical weapons. Now, I have not made a final decision about various actions that might be taken to help enforce that norm. As I've already said, I have had my military and our team look at a wide range of options. We have consulted with allies. We've consulted with Congress. We've been in conversations with all the interested parties. And in no event are we considering any kind of military action that would involve boots on the ground, that would involve a long-term campaign. But we are looking at the possibility of a limited, narrow act that would help make sure that not only Syria, but others around the world understand that the international community cares about maintaining this chemical weapons ban and norm. But again, I repeat, we're not considering any open-ended commitment. We're not considering any boots on the ground approach. What we will do is consider options that meet the narrow concern around chemical weapons, understanding that there's not going to be a solely military solution to the underlying conflict and tragedy that's taking place in Syria.
That's President Barack Obama speaking at a, not exactly a press conference, at a meeting held at the White House just moments ago. Before that, earlier this afternoon, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke, again, giving another impassioned speech laying out the U.S.'s position, or the Obama administration's position, on Syria. The Secretary of State said that America's credibility is on the line when it comes to its stance against the use of weapons of mass destruction and chemical weapons in conflicts such as the one going on in Syria. So a lot to talk about here today, and let's do so with our Week in Review panel. We are joined by Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor of the Boston Globe. Dante, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us today is Peniel Joseph. He's a history professor at Tufts University, author of the award-winning Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts. Peniel Joseph, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dante, let's first start with you. This is the second time that Kerry has spoken, the first time in the past few days that we've heard President Obama speak very clearly about what he's thinking about regarding Syria. You heard him say, no boots on the ground, no open-ended commitment, and yet it seems as if the administration is doing everything that it can to lay out its case for military action in Syria. What do you make of it?
It's hard not to be struck by the difference between the two statements. The bottom line of them was basically the same. Both Kerry and Obama are framing this not in terms of how this might help the Syrian rebels, which nobody really thinks an airstrike on Syria will necessarily, but they're framing it both in terms of international norms against chemical weapons. And they both, both Kerry and Obama, made the argument that any kind of strike would be limited. The difference between the two statements, Kerry, who spoke earlier, really came out swinging. And his statement sounded quite resolute, and you had every impression that a decision had been made. Obama certainly sounded like someone who was still trying to talk himself into it. Kerry sounded like he already had.
And Kerry said, you know, for example, that indiscriminate, quote, inconceivable horror of chemical weapons is what is happening in Syria. He also mentioned, Peniel, the fact that this would not be another Iraq. That came up a couple times in Secretary of State John Kerry's speech. So prolonged military intervention and maybe the American public's allergy to that right now, front and center in the minds of both John Kerry and President Obama. So what's your take on the language that we're hearing today?
Well, I think it's sad that a couple of days after celebrating the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Dr. King, who was such a pacifist, a promoter of nonviolence, that we're talking about dropping bombs in the Middle East. So I think that's sad. I think the language is a little bit ambivalent in terms of when we think about what Kerry said, which I do agree with Dante that it's resolute, the president much more ambivalent. I think the number one precept of an Obama doctrine has been no boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. And I think they've been great in that and resolute in 5 years. I think what's problematic about this president and our foreign policy is that after that notion of no boots on the ground, there really is no other foreign policy strategy. So there's no grand strategy of what to do in the Arab Spring, what to do in Libya, what to do in Egypt, what to do in Syria. So the president at times gets criticized for dithering, even though he's got drone strikes, the biggest president to do that, even though they've done a big counterinsurgency in Afghanistan and he's wound down the war in Iraq. And so I think he's sort of boxed himself in with that red line statement, and now the chickens are finally coming home to roost. But on some levels, this seems pointless because it's not going to help the people on the ground who are being slaughtered.
Now, Dante, Peniel makes an excellent point because I remember last week on Here and Now, NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Goldman basically said that all of his contacts inside the Pentagon were echoing what Peniel Joseph just said, that, you know, sure, military action can take place in Syria, but then what? I mean, we heard John Kerry today say a military solution is not a final solution, that the ultimate resolution of the Syrian conflict has to be a political one. But once, you know, you've dropped the bombs and sent in the drones and you have the fleet in the water on the, you know, on the coast, it's not so easy to disengage militarily unless you do have that plan.
No, well, of course not. And I think that's, other than the objection that some people are raising to having a bombing in the first place, there's the obvious question of the first action making the second action easier or seem necessary or at least harder to avoid. And I think we're in a weird point in American foreign policy. And I think the Syria dispute has certainly crystallize this, where we see something going on that's a total humanitarian disaster by any standard. You see the United States taking a very hard line, saying that someone like Assad should step aside or be forced out. But there's clearly a limit to U.S. influence that we perhaps haven't seen or at least haven't been used to talking about in quite a while. And, you know, there are these international norms that we believe in and at least rhetorically want to enforce. And yet there's not really a whole lot of other people who are willing to do it. And we're not necessarily willing to do it ourselves. It shows American foreign policy at a loss in a way that we're not usually used to seeing it.
Peniel Joseph, before we move on to the other news of the week for us here at Radio Boston, tell me a little bit more about what you make on how President Obama is handling this. This is a major foreign policy crisis, I don't think is too light a term to put on it, in his second term. What's your take on how his approach has been?
Well, I think his approach has been one of contemplation, but the president as professor at times seems like he's dithering. He doesn't want to get into boots on the ground conflict. He wants it to be a very, very limited conflict, but that actually constrains what he can do, because you have more leverage if you're saying it's going to be an open-ended conflict, and maybe Assad is going to be scared about that. Egypt is the same way. You have more leverage if you have more of a menu of options on the table. The president has really refused to talk about boots on the ground, rightfully so. That's the number one thing of the Obama doctrine. But after that, he's really sort of just winging it. The entire foreign policy team seems to be winging it, and really both our allies and our enemies realize that.
Well, you know, a little earlier you mentioned the fact that it's interesting that this is all happening this week, because on Wednesday, President Obama stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in the very same spot that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. did 50 years ago for the March on Washington. So given that, let's talk about the march and the interesting juxtaposition we've got between then and now. We have a little bit of tape of President Obama on Wednesday on the Lincoln Memorial.
The March on Washington teaches us that we are not trapped by the mistakes of history, that we are masters of our fate. But it also teaches us that the promise of this nation will only be kept when we work together. We'll have to reignite the embers of empathy and fellow feeling, the coalition of conscience that found expression in this place 50 years ago.
So, Peniel Joseph, a coalition of conscience, those words uttered by President Barack Obama. What do you make of how the nation remembered the March on Washington? And again, given the sort of bellicose tones coming out of the administration today.
Well, I think the commemorations were great. I think on a lot of levels, the nation really embraced the idea that 50 years ago, we had this tremendous event that really started a national conversation about race and democracy. I think we've been less willing to talk about policy and what are the policy implications. King talked about jobs and freedom, but in the 60s, he also said he didn't want to study war no more. That was King's exact words at the Riverside Church, April 4th, 1967. So 50 years later, where's the policy? The president could have talked about signing an executive order 2 days ago that was going to promote everything from ending gun violence to increasing the minimum wage for federal contract workers, right? He acknowledged racial discrimination, acknowledged growing economic inequality, but then, and this is shocking because he's the sitting president of the United States, acted like he couldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge paradox, because King was a social movement leader who couldn't pass legislation. He had to force and compel presidents to do so. Barack Obama's president of the United States. He's got the entire executive branch of government behind him, yet a lot of times he seems unwilling to use that power. And then it's juxtaposed against 2 days later, where now he's contemplating dropping bombs on Syria. So it's really sad and disappointing in terms of that symmetry.
Interesting. Dante, what's your response to that?
Well, it's interesting if we're still talking about comparing statements like we were in the minute ago. Mm-hmm. If you compare the language that the president used, and it was very evocative in the clip that you just played, compare that to the statement that he just made from the meeting with the Baltic leaders, and it couldn't be more pedestrian and prosaic. And so it's clear that his imagination is captured by the commemoration of the March on Washington in a way that this grinding question about Syria does not. But it's also the case that you on your show the other day, you had a guest on who was saying that who is a Boston participant in the March on Washington.
Right.
And she said that that she or and perhaps others who took part in it expected that the next day the jobs and the freedom that that were promised or that were hoped for at the march were going to be delivered. And the idea, and Peniel just alluded to this, the idea at that point that the president would be African-American would be almost unthinkable at that point. And so now that exists, and it turns out that there are many other barriers and huge difficulties in the way of enacting the kind of policies that people at the commemoration this week probably certainly favored.
Yeah, well, let's listen to a little bit more about from the commemoration that happened on the weekend, this past weekend, in Washington to mark the 50th anniversary of the historic civil rights rally there. Because, as Peniel, as you mentioned, it was a march on Washington for jobs and freedom. And so we've we've got some tape here from NAACP President Ben Jealous, who's talking about the fast food workers' strike that's been going on in multiple cities across the country, including in Boston, and how the issue of jobs and economic justice is still front and center in terms of where what America remains to accomplish.
And as we turn on our TVs tomorrow and see people walking out of places where they're being forced to survive on 725 by the thousands, let us commit to join them in fighting to lift up the bottom. Because as the top of that ladder has extended, the tethers at the bottom must be unleashed.
That's NAACP President Ben Jealous on the weekend at the commemorative march on Washington. Peniel Joseph, it was interesting to hear Dante Ramos say that in 1963, it was unthinkable that we'd have a black president, and yet we do. It seemed possibly more realistic that the minimum wage might at least keep up with inflation, and yet that hasn't happened at all. So what about the economic part of the march's legacy?
We have the biggest disparity between the rich and poor right now in the United States that we've seen since the Gilded Age, the late 19th century of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies. And when there was no labor unions that had muscle, young boys and girls were being killed in factories in Greenwich Village. And that's why the progressive era came about. So we need another progressive era. And Barack Obama, for many, was supposed to be that president, right? He was supposed to be that president who ushered in that new age. And
in his defense, he says he's advocating for the middle class right now. He's been doing a lot of speeches about the plight of the middle class.
He has, but in terms of congressional gridlock, there's going to be no major legislation passed for the rest of his term. Even immigration reform is not getting passed. So it would be up to the executive to sign whatever executive orders can be done to promote economic equality in the United States.
Dante, your take?
I'm not sure how much an executive order would necessarily accomplish, given the types of dynamics that we're talking about. That's not to say that he should or he shouldn't do it, but I'm not sure that that's up to the task necessarily. There's some really deep dynamics going on in the economy, and there are things that have been well discussed and well publicized, where the types of things that reward people at the top of the economic spectrum are far outstripping the kinds of things that reward people at the bottom. And in Obama, if you read analyses of his economic thinking, he's actually quite perceptive about this dynamic. What he hasn't been very articulate about necessarily has been any obvious solution to that. There doesn't really seem to be any clear ways of keeping the spread between rich and poor from widening. The thought had been a couple of years ago or a few years ago when he first came into office to try to do that through taxation and some other measures, but the problems in Congress or the makeup of Congress hasn't allowed that.
Mm. You know, in the last couple minutes that we have here, there's an economics and politics issue much closer to home that I want to touch upon before we wrap up the week in review, and that has to do with casinos, because the city of Boston has now officially inked a deal with Suffolk Downs to build a casino in East Boston. A vote still has to go through and licenses still have to be issued, so it's not 100% sure, but there's a deal now. And in a news conference on Tuesday, Mayor Tom Menino promised that it would be a windfall for the city.
More than $33.4 million up front for the community of East Boston to make improvements to their parks, their schools, to create a new youth and senior center. A projected $52 million annually ongoing payments to the city. Another $5 million spent annually by Suffolk Downs and the business community of East Boston to support the growth of their local economy. It sounds like a lot. It is.
Dante Ramos, that $33 million is a floor that the city of Boston would get if Suffolk Downs turns out to be incredibly profitable, which it could be. The money that the city might get could be even higher. So is it a good deal for Boston?
I've been a little skeptical of this process from the get-go. And one of the things that's noteworthy about this deal is how it is structured to, in particular, to appeal to the voters of East Boston, who under the casino legislation are the only ones who will have a vote on the on whether this deal should go up or down. It's a deal that theoretically affects the whole city. And I would argue that the decisions about where to allocate police and fire and questions about potential social ills that might be involved with a casino, those affect the citywide. But the decision was made to just deal with East Boston. And so the package reflects that it will be disproportionately geared towards improvements in East Boston. Now, you could imagine a much larger package or a much deeper way of using that money, either dedicating it towards education or to help East Boston integrate into the city as a whole, perhaps to build the Red Line Blue Line connector that has been talked about but not built for years. But you know, the projects that are discussed in that $33.4 million that you mentioned are things that are closer to the ground, are quicker return, and have the feel, like things like parks improvements and school improvements and things like that, of the kind of things that politicians push forward when they're looking to win elections.
Well, Peniel, I'm wondering, we've just got a little bit of time left to go, so what's your quick take on this?
Well, I think it's about, was there transparency in this process? How is it going to affect the city, especially the social ills that come with gambling? So, and when they talked about 4,000 jobs, what are those jobs? Will those jobs, are they guaranteed? Are they high-paying jobs? And really, what are the social costs, the moral hazard of gambling?
Yeah. Well, we've got just a few seconds to go, actually, gentlemen. So much news to talk about this week that our hubbubs will have to be short and sweet. So, Dante, you got a couple seconds to give me your hubbub story for the week.
Sure. It wasn't as anticlimactic as Geraldo Rivera opening up Al Capone's vaults on live TV, but the cracking of an old safe at the State House this week yielded more historical curiosities than actual hidden treasures. There were, it turns out, according to a Globe story this week, World War II bonds or World War I bonds and some old records. Now, this is a little bit disappointing to me as a journalist because you want to hear that there are, gold bullion or the big dig sketched out on a cocktail napkin,
right,
or something like that. But probably it's for the better that our officials aren't stashing things like that in safes and then forgetting about them.
Peniel, your hubbub for the week?
Well, everybody talks about a national conversation about race. We should have a national conversation about race. Why aren't we having it? At Tufts, we actually are going to have it September 12th, the National Dialogue on Race Day at Tufts University. It's sponsored by the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy. Michael Curry of the Boston NAACP is going to be there. Diane McWhorter, Pulitzer Prize winner of the book Carry Me Home about Birmingham, Alabama, is going to be there, and a lot of other people.
Great. So a national conversation of race right here in Medford.
Right here in Medford.
Terrific. Well, my hubbub is actually the passing of Nobel Prize winning poet Seamus Heaney. We will be hearing a lot more about him in All Things Considered, I'm sure, so I will leave you with that. Peniel Joseph, professor of history at Tufts University and director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Always great to have you, Dante. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, there will be more news on Syria in All Things Considered, but for now, stick with Radio Boston. There's a lot more of the show coming up, including some history and some great music later this hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's more Radio Boston after a moment.